Welcome to the Two Regular Teachers podcast. My name is Rick Kayla Thompson.
My name's Adam Lavaz. Thanks for joining us for not only episode 49, but the Christmas episode. Can't believe we've finally made it, mate. I actually thought I would have fallen in a heap and maybe not crawled over the finish line.
It's amazing that we've had time to produce this episode this week, Adam. I feel like, and Harry Potter fans will understand this, I feel like we're like Hermione Granger in, I think it's in the third book, where she gets a time turner, which allows her to squeeze in between time and take extra classes but not miss anything else. And it's like we've got ourselves a time turner to stop everything that's happening at school this week so we can record our Christmas podcast.
Yeah, and that's actually a really good analogy to go with. I actually like the analogy. I don't know if we've got any Seinfeld fans out there, but the Kramer, when he goes on his AIDS walk and he's not fit, and Jerry keeps going, "You're never going to make it," and everyone's left. He gets to the end, everyone's left. "I told you he wasn't going to make it." And then around the corner, he stumbles and he falls over and literally pulls himself over the finish line once everyone else is finished. That's how I kind of feel this week.
We are doing that, but it's amazing. As soon as we pressed record, a bit of we've come to life, haven't we?
We have.
And we're very lucky tonight, Adam. We've got a couple of guests and possibly a third, and we might mention that later on. We are going to talk to our first-year graduate in Melbourne, and we'll talk more about that later. But it's great to welcome back our old friend. We haven't seen him since I talked with him in the depths of winter up at Swinburne University. Mm-hmm. Please welcome back to the podcast again. And I love you dropping in at Christmas. Yeah. John Pearce. Welcome, John.
Thanks, gentlemen. Thank you. And look, I'm usually brought in for the milestone ones. And, you know, I'm looking at the numbers there during the week, and I'm going... 49? I don't even crack it for the half century. What are you doing, guys? Come on, you're going to crab two, and you know, your time thingy with behind Hermione and everything. Squeezed two in last week.
It's funny, because that's my fault, because we were on track, and then I fell in a heap. I think it was a Wednesday where I actually boxed you in the morning and said, I cannot make it. I'm actually going home sick. I couldn't make it. I was just an absolute shambles. So, John, it's my fault. I'm sorry, mate.
That's... Yeah. Forgiven, totally. But I can understand.
Yeah, thank you, mate. Look, I'm impressed, though, that you've got down here and enjoyed an ice cream on the way, on your way down, that probably enjoyed a little bit too much. Would that be correct?
Look, they don't make magnums like they used to, and especially, you know, I had the aircon on too, and it's shattered.
Yeah.
Chocolate all over the shirt, and you know, you look down and you go to reach on it, and as soon as you put your fingers on it, melts.
It makes it worse.
Yep. Yep. Beautiful light grey shirt. Mm. Brown stains all over.
It's never just a dribble either. It's a big bit too, isn't it, that gets you?
You try and clean it up, don't you?
Yeah.
Well, to give some context to our listeners, John and I attended many a conference in the early days when John used to sort of get me to some of these things, and we would leave early and we might stop for a hot takeaway breakfast, and John would always get out the serviette or the towel to sort of drape over the shirt to make sure he didn't drop any crumbs. John tells me tonight that he didn't put the serviette or the towel over when he was eating a chocolate ice cream.
Yeah.
It's almost... I don't know what you were thinking.
You won't make that mistake again, will you, John?
No, I'll make a different one.
No, make a different one instead. So look, we do have a lot to get through tonight, Rick. We're really excited to have John here, and we're really excited to have our next guest who's going to be on next, and hopefully the hairy man will be on later on as we go along. We're hoping to get him on. It can be hard to get him out of the trees, so we'll wait and see how that one shapes up.
It can be, Adam, yeah. So look, without further ado, we need to get on Skype, and we need to make our call. Mm-hmm. So let's get into it. Right, Adam, for our first segment tonight, it's not a topic, it's a segment, and it's our second special guest for the night.
It is.
And we'd like to welcome, I can't believe I'm saying this, but a long-time listener, and as John said earlier, I guess a first-time caller.
Yeah, well, we are on Skype, so we are calling that in, so I think that's pretty apt.
It is, and so we'd like to welcome Claire Piscineri, a prep teacher in her first year from Melbourne, and Claire's written a few comments for us over the time and retweeted us, which we're really appreciative of. Welcome, Claire, to Two Regular Teachers.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for having me on. I'm really excited to be able to share some of my limited experience from this year with you.
Because that's something, Claire, that Rick and I have spoken about a lot this year, is we wanted to have some of the perspectives from a first-year graduate teacher. Obviously, Rick and myself, and obviously John, has been longer in the game than we have, but it's been a long time since we've been first-year graduate teachers. So the landscape and what is expected of a graduate teacher has changed. Do you mind just giving us a little bit of background about how your year's been and some of the successes that you've had?
Yeah, so I guess it's been a pretty busy year. I'm a prep teacher, so from the start of the year, we did a lot of work with our group on transitions. I work in a flexible learning space, so there was a lot of change and adjustment to that style of teaching, which I absolutely love, and getting to know my team. I guess some of the successes that I've had this year were with some particular children and their attitude to school, who probably weren't that ready or that keen on school, and who have are going to leave me on Friday with a big smile on their face and will be ready to go into grade one. So I feel like that's probably one of my the big success story for me, is having kids who just really want to be at school.
That's great. You hear that. You do hear prep teachers say that a lot. It does take sometimes a full year or at least three quarters of a year for that kind of stuff to happen. What type of socioeconomic kind of, you know, level are we talking about here? I'm guessing it might be slightly lower by what you just said.
It is slightly lower. We have a lot of people who come here on 457 visas, so we have a lot of students come in and out of the class. So I think I'm up to 12 changes in my class this year. So I started with 21 and had 3 or 4 go out, and I've had a lot of extras added. So a lot of people moving around. It's sort of a middle socioeconomic area, but yeah, a lot of families from India. I think I have 14 children in my class who were born in India.
Wow. So, yeah. Well, that's amazing. We talked to Lee Burns from Laylaw earlier in the year, and he comes from quite a multicultural school, and this is quite foreign to Adam and I, particularly on the Ballerine. And John, you would know, being from this area, and even from the places you've taught in as well.
Yes, it's totally foreign, that sort of notion that, you know, you've got a transient population where half a grade basically comes in and out during the year. That's you know,
unbelievable,
and such a young level too, like as you move through the school, the senior school and things like that, they're a lot more easier to bring in, I would imagine, than somebody who's got just come in partway through.
Yeah, that's right. And what's the impact on the kids, Claire, in the sense that the ones that are there, that have been there all the time, does it have a negative impact? Do they kind of just go with it, and sort of that's a learned habit and things that, well, people are coming and going? Do they handle it okay?
I think they handle it really well. And I guess the culture that we set up in the classroom was to be really inclusive. So I guess the kids that had been in the class all year were aware that, you know, kids come and go. But I guess for the kids that came in, they weren't that aware of our culture and our expectations, and it was really difficult. Even in term four, I had a child turn up 3 weeks ago, and then I had one before that 2 weeks before that. Wow. And it's really difficult to set those expectations again and revisit that culture when we expect that all the children understand and know that. So that's something that I found really difficult about that, the transient population with our school. So, but the kids that are in our class, they're fabulous. They just really take it on board and look after all of the kids and include them outside and then when they're doing different learning tasks. So it's just great.
Yeah, that is fascinating. I'd love to talk probably for the whole segment about that. But we've got a couple of planned topics which we had your assistance on. In the preparation for the episode, you mentioned that bedtimes and the times that students go to bed has been something that that's really opened your eyes this year for positive or negative. Well, that's kind of what I want to find out. So, what have you seen this year that's kind of perked your interest in that sort of topic in education?
I've seen it both ways. I've seen children who go to bed at 6 or 7 o'clock at night and have their 12 hours sleep, and they are really ready to go when they come to school. And I've had other children who are turning up late and looking quite tired. And then when the question was posed, and as a graduate teacher, I didn't really think that this was a question to ask. You know, I've learnt a lot of things that I didn't think was part of my job this year, but...
Surprise, surprise.
Yeah.
But asking about bedtimes, I really didn't think was one of them. And the first conversation I had was over the phone, where I found out, I was lucky it wasn't in person, because the shock on my face I wouldn't have been able to hide it. Yeah. Was that I was going to bed at 11 o'clock at night.
Every
night, and she looked so sad and so not happy to be at school, and I really pushed her parents to put her to bed earlier. But I guess the cultural difference was that they have dinner at about 9 o'clock, so you know that was a bit of a problem. But this child who went to bed, I think she started going to bed at 9:30 and having about 8 or 9 hours sleep, she has just flourished for the rest of the year, because I had to basically put the hard word on them and say, if they do not go to bed early, I won't get the best out of them at school, and they will not learn to the best of their ability. So I need you to do that. And I think I had 7 different conversations with children and parents in my class of children who are falling asleep in the morning, not even at night time. I had an incident where I had a child who turned up on his first day of school in my class at the end of term 2, and when he was at music, he actually fell asleep in the class and he couldn't be woken up, and we thought he'd passed out and called an ambulance for him.
Wow. That's unbelievable.
That is phenomenal.
And look,
every single leadership team member was out of the school as well, so I had to make a call and calling the ambulance. It was a bit of a scary day.
That's amazing.
And it is amazing. But good on you, Claire, for having those conversations, because I think all three of us here too would agree that in the early part of your career, one of the toughest things is actually going to parents with something that you want them to do, and actually, not so much confronting them, but going, look, there's things that you need to change in your child's habits, and going to them and actually saying, look, you need your child to go to bed earlier, these are things you need to do. It's easy for parents to really take that personally and take it as a tough criticism and get quite angry or get quite defensive. But for you to go and do that, I'm sure you'd agree that early on, was that a tough thing? Did you need to sort of build up the courage a little bit to do that?
It was a tough thing, but I guess for me, that was one thing I wanted to be upfront about, was my conversations with parents. So every afternoon I go out into the yard so that they can see that I'm available, and and so that it's not just me stomping out into the yard when something's gone wrong. So that's my attitude. I think it's better to be upfront with parents, and if they need something from me, that's fine. And then if I feel like they're taking up too much of their time, then I'll say, I need to make a time with you about this. So it can be really tough, and I guess it's a question that I'll ask come February in the English Online interviews that we'll hold with each of the parents. It's not something that I ask, but I'll definitely be asking that this year so I can get on top of that early, because it's just amazing the amount of tired children in our class that don't get enough sleep.
Yeah, that's phenomenal. I mean, it really is phenomenal, the falling asleep. It reminded me of some feedback that I saw in our, and this is a whole other topic, but just to touch on it, just to finish on this topic, some feedback I saw in our school's newsletter this week was the leadership team answering questions about the BYOD program to parents. And there was sort of 6 positives and negatives, and the parents got to share what they saw was good and bad about it. And one of the things in the negative column was that some parents had said that because I've had to get this device for school, my child is taking it into their room at night, and as a consequence is not sleeping very well because they won't go to sleep because they've got their head buried in the screen. And that's a whole other thing, but I thought, you just wonder with some of these kids, I mean, aside from the fact that the family you mentioned having a late dinner, you wonder what's put in place to, encourage sleep in the first place.
Yeah, that was part of the conversation, was ensuring that they don't have screen time before bed, because I had they said they'd put them to bed at 8:30 and they wouldn't go to sleep till 10, and then I found out that they were having the iPads in bed and things like that. So I had to say, you can't let them watch TV or have screen time before bed. And we actually had one of our parents who's a sleep specialist come to our parent information night for preps next year and told them exactly what they should be doing with the sleep routine. So that's something that our whole school is going to be focusing on as part of their parent information nights next year.
Wow, that's fascinating. Well, we look forward to maybe in the new year getting you back on again, or at least hearing an update on what happens, if anything changes.
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned your working situation briefly at the start, and John and Adam and I were talking off air about how the three of us have all worked at some time, particularly late in our career, in some form of flexible learning space. And John and I have riffed on the fact that we worked in a multi-purpose room together, which we'll might touch on again sometime during the podcast. But your first year out, and you've gone straight into a flexible learning space. That's been in the news recently. Adam and I talked about it in a previous podcast. How have you found it? I know you touched on it just briefly earlier. And what's your take after 12 months on this kind of learning environment?
I think overall the take home is that it's really positive. There are definitely some negatives with it. I think the positives that I've found out, that I've definitely got out of it, is that when you're in a great team, it works so, so well. So my colleague and I, we can share a look across the room and we can stop a task, we can stop or change things if we need to, because we've we work together so closely. We have all, so we have two classes in our room, so up to 50 children. And so we'd have maybe 10 differentiated sessions, which works better for the group of children that we have, because we had children working, you know, at a, you know, pre-prep level, and then other children working above grade one. So, you know, we have to create those differentiated sessions for them. I think I feel like our planning was a lot better, because I didn't have to plan just for me. We could plan as a whole team and do everything together. So it sort of almost halved our planning, which was amazing. And then we just divide up who had to prepare what for different sessions. I think the sense of community is huge in our classroom. Like, all of our 50 students, they know that they belong to that prep grade, and I'm their home group teacher, and the other, my colleagues, their other home group teacher, but they will go to either one of us for any issue whatsoever. And they know that we'll both teach them, you know, just the same.
So. And that's fantastic, Claire. And I think a lot of people who work in the flexible learning spaces would say the same sort of things. Obviously, that you can have more classes. I know, Rick, in yours, you've had, you know, more classes and bigger groups in there. I want to play the devil's advocate for a second, though, and actually, so you've obviously said there are the positives and the negatives. As a graduate teacher in that flexible learning space, what do you feel has been, not necessarily a negative, I think I'll change the word as maybe a challenge, but some things that have challenged you this year about using those spaces?
I think a challenge is perhaps when you and your colleague aren't on the same page about something. That's a challenge, and I think if you're not communicating that well, that can be a challenge. And, you know, when people are tired and when people have other things going on, you know, that can definitely come to the surface. Noise is definitely a challenge. Yeah.
Particularly with preps, isn't it? I know that at our school, when we first got our BER, we had all our 1-2 classrooms in there for a year, and that just didn't work. They didn't respect the space enough. It was too noisy. So it's actually got swapped to the 3-6s, and now it's going to just be a 5-6 classroom. So I'm sure, yes, the preps can be pretty loud at the best of times, so I'm sure that it can impact sometimes on their learning.
It definitely can, but I think as they've gone through the year, they're a lot better at it. I think week 11 in term 4 is not really a good indication of them working at a proper noise level, but we have different voices that they can use in the classroom, so we set out those expectations before every session, you know, using a whisper voice or a discussion voice or a head voice. You know, we put classical music on to keep them calm. You know, we do meditation all together so that it just sort of, they have quiet time as well. So, and I guess, you know, if we want to do dancing or drama, I read one of the comments on the previous post that there was a particular teacher that wanted to do drama in her class. We just organise that when the other group's out at specialist, or we do it all together, or find another space to do it. We don't find that that's an issue.
Again, so. Everything you're saying to me does, and I'm going to throw to you, John, in a second with your thoughts, but to me it all still comes back to team. And I know we say a lot about the students, but I still think everything that's been said in this whole segment about it is about a team of staff working together and putting in those expectations. John, after I know you've been out of it for a little while, but your thoughts?
Yeah, well, I used to actually enjoy the prospect of being able to work with someone who was way younger in both in experience and age than myself. The couple of times that I worked in that sort of team environment with a colleague who was around the same age, same experience and everything else were probably the worst experiences, being unproductive and everything else, because there was so much presumption around in the area, or you felt as if you could disagree quite vehemently and that. Whereas with a younger teacher, I found that I got asked lots of questions that made me justify what was going on. And also it gave me cover, because I could also use the younger teacher almost as a proxy and say, well, I don't know, you'll have to ask. So I don't know, has that been your experience? I'm presuming that your colleague is older or more experienced than you.
Yeah, so my colleague's only one extra year experience. So we had she's a second year teacher and I'm a graduate teacher. She'd done some CRT work before, but I guess we're both mature age students, you know. We're 22 when we graduated, so I guess we have that experience behind us. But I had a lot of, we've got a fabulous mentor teacher who's been teaching for 40 years and he's still so on his game. He's an amazing teacher. And then I had my mentor teacher as well. So we always had people to go to. But I guess in terms of us being just in the room, we sort of laid out at the start of the year what our strengths were. And so my colleague, she's very creative and very arty, and she thinks outside the box, whereas my strengths sort of lie in getting things really organized and using ICT and just, yeah, those were my strengths. So we sort of divided those up, and if we needed to do something really quickly and get it done, she would do some sort of display and then I would do the other organisation part of planning and things like that. So just sort of divided up the responsibility so we didn't pull our hair out.
Yeah, that's great.
And look, again, it comes down to that great communication. And John's still got his mouth open about when you mentioned the 40 years experience
stuff. That's even more. Yeah. Way more than I. Fascinating. Yeah. And so you've both given each other a Christmas gift and best wishes then? That's always a good sign.
Not yet. So we've still got 2 days to go. I'm still yet to get a present because I've just been trying to get everything done. Yeah. But we've been concentrating getting all the kids' presents done, burning 50 CDs of photos for them,
Yeah. Speaking of the end of the year, we'd like to wish you the best for the last little part of your first year, Claire. Mm. And it's just been brilliant to have you on and get your insights. And I think we'd certainly like to get maybe back on next year's to see whether all the negative feelings have come into the profession. No, just certainly joking. But all the best, and again, thanks for being a supporter of the podcast.
Oh, it's a fabulous podcast. I really love listening to you guys. It's all so relevant, and I really love listening to it. Look forward to it every week. Merry Christmas, everyone.
Merry Christmas to you too, Claire, and the check is in the mail.
Oh, I hope so.
It's as blank as the other ones.
Yeah. But thank you, Claire. We do wish you a Merry Christmas, and we'll definitely have you on next year.
Oh, thank you. I look forward to it.
So now that we've finished with the Skype, John, time to pick your brain, so to speak. And there's a few things we want to discuss with you, but you've come from Ballarat today, as we discussed with the ice cream incident in the intro. And but you've been down there, I know, sharing some of your wares and some of the stuff that you're doing these days. And Adam and I, we're talking off air in the lead up to this episode about how we still feel like in the whole world of gadgets and coding and I guess the digital curriculum, even though we've got our hands still in ICT, we feel like we're still a little bit behind on that. And I know that it's kind of where you're going these days. And I noticed on a lot of my social media feeds of late, Instagram and on Twitter, I've been following Code the Future, that Beck Spink's been championing in schools. And I know that somehow some of the stuff you've got tonight's linked, and you've brought some of your gadgets in. Can you first just maybe give us a little background for those people who are like us that don't know a lot about where this is fitting into the curriculum these days, and why coding and these sort of gadgets that can be made and all that sort of stuff is, why is it important?
Well,
short answer.
That's a loaded question.
That is an absolutely loaded question. Well, the short glib answer is because Mel and Bill both tell us that it is, so therefore it must be. Yes. When you get unanimity within the politicians, it's got to be a good thing. Mm. But probably the bad thing about it all is that you've got the politicians in there saying this sort of stuff, and it may well tend to make things go not quite in the way that it might better have gone in other ways. But the simple matter is that all of the surveys and the study and everything else indicates that so much of whatever we're going to be doing in our future is going to be governed by algorithms and the way computers work and manifest what it is. And so it's a way of thinking as much as anything. Whilst it's like so many of the things that we deal with in schools, we need not necessarily know everything about it. We certainly need to know of it and to be cognizant and to be aware of its limitations and also the benefits and so forth. So I
want to jump in there because seeing all the gadgets and looking at the digital curriculum that's going to come in obviously in 2017, with the curriculum and things, what are in your mind some of the real benefits of the students learning about these things?
Probably the key benefit is, and this is where schools and education, politicians and everything else have to be aware of, it's not necessarily the notion of what seems to be traditional education, in that, you know, there's a process that we have to go down lockstep, boom, 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 and that sort of stuff. So much of it is more in a way of thinking about thing, and a way of being able to look at a problem or identify a problem, then look at offering some sort of way to solve that problem, address that issue, then look to ways that we can look for patterns and things that, that are involved in that particular solution, testing the solution, then going back and revisiting and seeing whether it actually met that problem, and then seeing if we can improve it, and all that sort of stuff. And so much of the stuff can be done without computers.
That's right. And I love the sound of that, because one of the things I think that comes up in schools these days is kids don't do enough of that in any of their learning, you know, maths and even English and things. They don't want to, they see a problem and it's a challenge, and they don't, you know, that resilience to actually try different things. So what you're talking about there, about actually going, well, I'm going to try this one. How did it work? Kind of worked. How can I improve it? And eventually get to the answer. They kind of go, unless I can see the answer right in front of my face, I'm almost not going to do it. And to hear those sorts of things actually gives them not just, you know, technological skills, but even life skills as well.
Are you seeing it hitting... I mentioned Code the Future, and I've also seen a lot of things shared from Geelong College of late too, with Adrian Cam and some of the stuff going on there that I think is linked to at least a lot of this creating and algorithms and things. But how much are you seeing... Are we seeing this coming into primary more at the moment? Or secondary, or is it balanced, or is it not even a question that's worth considering at this stage?
No, it's across all areas. The benefits of the primary area, for the primary area, are that, you know, we you've got a classroom teacher, and you've got that capability to you know, not be stuck to a timetable and things like that. Whereas, you know, that's always been one of the problems in the secondary area and so forth. You know, that you've got a timetable, you've got and you can't go on, or or if we've reached a level within 20 minutes, my gosh, we've got, you know, we've got 35, 40 feet, whatever, time left over, what on earth are we going to do? We can't really, and that sort of stuff. So there's an issue there. There's also issues of, well, okay, teacher knowledge and so forth, and the deficit and the differential between where students are and the teachers, and also the differential between where some students are within the classroom, and that sort of magnifies as you go further on.
Yeah. Well, I was going into it. Yeah, I was that leads into my next question, because I think, you know, we've seen it creep into the news media of late, and I there might be the odd article, and what I see, and this is coming from a regular teacher point of view, is, and this could, and again, this is probably just the news, and getting back to what you said about the government and the politicians, but you see kind of that shop front thing. You see a robot, when you see kids smiling and things like that. And sure, there's got to be, you know, gimmicks now to get people in. But how is it going to break that? How are we going to get... Because I think regular teachers might look at that and go, well, I don't... Getting back to what you said, I don't know anything about that stuff. I like a robot. You get that robot in and let it walk and I'll be happy. But I don't know anything about the behind-the-scenes stuff. How's this? How will that barrier be broken down?
Well, it can be hugely enabling as a teacher, because I've actually gone down to a local primary school. One of the local primary schools actually had me down there to come in with some kids and work with them. What I did was simply just go in there with a couple of these robot toys, and then put it out in front of them, explained a couple of things, and said to them, well, okay, you tell me how it all works. Basically, I sort of knew a little bit, but that approach let me then see what they could do with it, what they would see as problems, what they would see as opportunities, and that, and then I can sit back and I can become back to where I was more comfortable. I could be the teacher and asking, well, is that all it does? What about if we did this? Could this happen? Have you thought about I don't necessarily need to know anything else. I had another experience the other week with one of the little robots, which is a ball, a ball called Sparrow, and people might see with the release of Star Wars, it's going to be the toy of the
toy du jour. Absolutely.
If you're BB-8. If you're unsure, we'll put a photo on the blog of John's.
Yeah. Oh, well, you BB-8s anyway. I took along this little Sparrow ball, and the students there at the school where we were working actually had a swimming pool on campus, and they said, "Look, can we? You know, what happens if you put it in water?" And I said, "Don't know." I had seen it on the movies and everything else. I'd not actually tested it, but I said, well, if it sinks, who's going to go and get it? If it leaks, and who's going to pay the $199?
Mm, exactly.
Oh, yeah, but can we try it? I knew it worked brilliantly.
Yeah.
But I was still diffident about it. Anyway, but somebody was always game, so we took it down, we put it on the pool. I put it on the pool cover until somebody just had to go and drop it in the water.
Yeah, of course.
And then the screams of delight when it actually flipped around in the water and went swimming.
Oh, man. Fantastic, you know? Yeah.
It gives you the opportunity as a teacher to be dumb again.
Yes, yeah.
But in a knowledgeable situation where you can ask the questions.
Yeah. Ask the questions freely, yes. Yes. Yeah.
And look, and I know we've got some other things we want to talk to you with you, John, and I love talking about this. You have brought one thing in to show us tonight as well. Can you give us, I know we're on a podcast, so it's a little bit hard to sort of show, we will put some pictures on, but what's one of the things you have brought in tonight to show us? Can you give us a little bit of a description, I guess?
Oh, these little guys are called Ozobot.
Yes.
And it's a robot that's the size of half an egg.
Yeah, it is half an egg, isn't it? That's what
basically
it looks like, yeah.
Yeah. And look, it can be worked at a very low level by putting it on a little track that's pre-drawn and so forth, and you can just put it on there and it'll drive around and follow the track.
Yep.
And little lights, little LED lights inside will react and do some certain things. You can also, if you want to, get texters and draw your own path with texters and so forth. So when you work with students and everything else, well, they can design their own paths and things like that. But then you can throw it onto the iPad, and the iPad then has got the capability to draw on it, the path and that, to do it on the iPad. There's also an app that will let it dance and so forth, so you can put it to music. Then there are puzzles and so forth that go with it. And then there's another app that takes it up to another level again, which works like Scratch. Wow.
Yeah.
And you program it, and then it works totally independently of anything else, and you just put it down. And real life applications for this sort of stuff is when I took it up to the Earth Ed Center today and everything else, and the people up there were looking at it and everything else, they're going, that's the same as the trucks in the mines, the autonomous driving trucks in the mines, where they don't have a person in the truck. The truck just follows a prearranged thing, and it goes at certain speeds, does certain things at certain times, tips up, da-dip, 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 da-dip. And that's basically the same sort of principle.
Absolutely, it's
great to sit here, Rick, and see, because it's still going. It's going around the track and doing its things while we're having this conversation. You haven't had to pick it up, move it, or change it, or do anything. It's still just following and picking up. It's fantastic.
Yeah, and if you're listening to us and you've got your browser open, you can see it actually doing it, because we've been filming some of it while we've been talking. Well, thanks for sharing the gadgets, John. There's lots. I know you've got your suitcase there, but we are
full of it.
absolutely
full of it.
But we are ready to move on.
We are.
The second topic we wanted to tackle with Mr. PBBS tonight is something that harks back to our Christmas episode last year, Adam, when John shared some fantastic stories from the teacher college days of learning how to write proper cursive handwriting and what have you on a chalkboard. And in the lead up to this episode, I kind of tweeted John and said, can you delve back into the memory bank of those days? And so I'm just going to hand over to you, John. I'm sure there was something else that is quite different to what goes on today that you've got for us from those memories. How did you go with your trip down memory lane?
I'm going to draw on something that I did halfway through the year, actually at the conference we were all at. And that was the Spark Talk, and what I did there was I trawled back through things, and I sort of looked to try and find out where either advocated for or being taught things that were no longer within the orbit of what happened. So as I went back through and everything else, I managed to pull up a couple of images and one of the images was the image of a slide rule and a table of logarithms.
Right, now, I'm intrigued.
I look across and exactly.
Yeah.
But they were de rigueur. They were very much the main point of so much of maths in the secondary school. We had to learn how to use our table of logarithms and our slide rule. If you ask me now how to work with them and everything else and that sort of stuff, I have absolutely no idea.
Well, I plead ignorance here. What is a slide
rule?
Yeah,
me too. I've got no idea.
Well, a slide rule, and you'd have to look up the pictures and everything else, was basically look like a normal ruler. Only in the middle of the ruler, there was another piece of plastic or wood, if you go back far enough, it was wood, which would slide up and down. So this was the sliding thing. And then along the, over the top of the ruler was another little slidey bit too that would move up and down. And so, and here I am, I'm stuck absolutely now because I cannot remember, apart from sliding these two things in unison or contradiction to each other and that sort of stuff, you could calculate various bits and pieces. Right. And it has something to do with angles and sorts of things and all sorts of other bits and pieces.
It's very interesting because you know what that reminds me of? It reminds me of back in high school. I'm sure you would have done them. I don't know, John, if you did them. Box and whisker plots. Now, seeing the slide rule and doing those things, it reminds me of the old box and whisker plots where you had there. Did you do those, John, at all, the box and whisker plots?
No, it bypassed us, but then we had to interpret them when we got into
student data.
And still.
The box with the line and end and the long bits on the box and whisker plots, I've never used it. Never ever used it since high school. I feel no need to. I don't go home and go, I might look at the average of the M&Ms I've got in my bag or something like that. Never used the box and whisker plot.
Well, I'm just wondering with the slide rule, was it something that each student was given?
Was it
on the book list, so to speak?
It totally was, yes. Yeah, and your log tables.
And was this something that then you, in terms of teaching, like were you, when you first started, was it something that was used by students even then? I mean, that's not going back so far, but is it?
This is where you draw a blank. I cannot actually remember teaching with it, but I can vividly remember secondary schools and everything else and being taught it and that sort of stuff. So, you know, sort of, it poses the question as to what it is, you know, that seems vital at that particular time. And this this harks back to this whole robotics coding thing and everything else. And it asks me a question in some respects as to, okay, why are we bothering to do this with preps and grade ones and twos or grade threes or even grade sixes?
Yeah.
Because in 5 years or 10 years' time, when they come out of the workforce, maybe there are going to be computers that do all this sort of coding stuff for us or do that problem solving and that sort of stuff. Or
that's right.
So if we teach it as a process, it becomes self-defeating because we got taught the slide rule and the logarithms as a process as opposed to what it was that they were trying to do for us.
Yes.
Yeah. But if we teach it as a way of thinking about things and everything else, we've got a chance that may live longer than the actual teaching of any particular language or, you know, the fact that I can drive my little Ozobot with a Blockly program or something like that. Mm.
Well, that to finish off, that kind of goes back to even to a lot of things that are happening in education these days. And I recall a conversation with a new colleague a couple of years ago at my most recent school where we were talking about blogs and wikis and my experience with them. And he said, this person said, yeah, look, we did blogs and wikis back in 2010. Yeah, we've done that. Almost like you would say, you know, we did that NAPLAN test or we used the slide rule back then. And again, I think, you know, maybe blogs and wikis have been around for a while, but again, it's like is it something that you would use for a different type of learning or some type of product or understanding you're going to have at the end.
Mm. And then therein lies, you actually identify the problem there. We did blogs and wikis. No, we don't do blogs and wikis.
Yeah.
We use a blog or a wiki if we've got a purpose, and our purpose is to share, our purpose is to explore, our purpose is to explain, our purpose is just to get things down so that we can have it in one space really nice and quickly and that sort of stuff. If we look at it from that reason, well, then it can live, and that reason is still there for some people, and we don't have to do it every week, month or whatever. We can just come back and... Yep. Dip in and dip out as we need to.
Exactly. Yeah. Great. So we do want to move on to part three, but before we move on to part three, for our listeners, a little bit of homework. We want you to go and look up slide rules and logarithms and report back to us, and because we're going to have a questionnaire for episode 50 that you're going to have to answer, so be prepared.
Well, I was thought he was talking about something in soccer or AFL for a second when he said the slide rule.
The slide rule, sliding in for a tackle, that sort of stuff. So let's get straight into part three.
Part three, as Adam mentioned before, John, I know that you've been out of the classroom for a few years and you and I worked together before that. But to me, you're still, you know, heavily involved, you know, in education and the things around it. So I wanted to ask you to complete our segment is, to you right now at the end of 2015, what's the biggest, not necessarily the one that you're most passionate about, but the biggest item and change in education that we're seeing right now in, I guess, our state and our nation? You can broaden further if you want. The question's already pretty big. What's standing out to you?
Biggest challenge, I think, is for educators is to be able to say, I don't know, and mean it and use that. as a power tool.
Mm. With confidence, you mean?
Like, with confidence, say, yeah. It sort of has other things attached to it, like, I don't know, let's find out, or I don't know, that's a really good question, or I don't know and I don't think it really matters, or something else. To be able to take ourselves down from that exalted position of being the font of everything, and that's
right. And I think it's tougher for teachers today to actually go and say, I don't know, because of the, the PDP things that happen, and the expectations and things, and the feeling of actually going and saying, you know what, guys, I know this has been brought in things, I don't know. Like, can you give me a bit more information? Can you teach me a bit more? Can you do that stuff? There is a little bit of that fear of going in and saying that you feel like that you're going to be judged, and you're going to be told, well, you should know about it, but you need to have that support for someone to say, well, you don't know. Okay, well, come on, I'll come in on Tuesday and we'll go through it for an hour, or do something like that. There is that fear in, well, I'm talking from even me personally, that fear of saying I don't know is really prevalent more in teachers today. I think you're absolutely right there, John.
Yeah, and comes back, well, that old adage, you're a teacher, you're supposed to know.
Yes.
Sorry. Or it's also related to now the fact that, so much of your performance and everything else is judged against or capability and ability to be able to do things and that sort of stuff. And sometimes this sort of harks back a little bit to the conversation we had that I butted in with Claire in there and everything else, and the fact that I liked to be able to work with a teacher who was younger and everything else, because I could use that as a sort of a proxy and be able to say, I really don't know, but you, if you ask Rick, that won't make me look dumb.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
It's cover. And that's the thing, because it's really bad if I should be able to.
Because leadership don't expect the graduates to know. Like, if a graduate goes and says, look, I don't know, it's commonplace. But if someone with 10 years, 20, 30 years experience says, look, this has been brought in, I don't know, it's kind of, well, you should know. You've got all this experience, you've got all this knowledge, you've got all these things, why don't you know? But I think that's kind of unfair, because what do they talk about teachers? That the old adage is, we're lifelong learners, we're always learning, we're always getting better. But then if you come to say, I don't know, well, you should know, it kind of goes against the grain a little bit.
But there's a lot of pressure, and some of it might be perceived, on graduates when they come out to know everything. And I have not seen a graduate that I've worked with since I've been in the job that hasn't looked like they are just, and they are on the ball, but haven't really put that show out, because they want to show leadership. I know exactly what I'm doing, employ me again, whether it's a contract or not. And I think what you mentioned, John, is great, because how good would it be though if they are able to work in a team where there is that confidence to go, I don't know. And I think being on Twitter and things like that and sharing with people outside your staff early gives you that, because some people feel a bit more there's a bit more confidence being behind a screen, and you think, gee, there's people out there like me. Claire's kind of picked that up even with listening to our podcast, as she mentioned. I think if we can somehow break down that barrier, in more schools where there's that, I guess, that not to worry about, it doesn't matter. If you don't know something, it's okay to learn it, and you're not going to lose your job over it type.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And it runs against so much of, what the Pollies, what Malcolm and Bill have both said with their innovation statements and everything else. And that, underpinning some of that, so much of that is the notion that you fail early. And that failure is very much part of the process. And it should be seen as part of the process. Yep. The major success is drawn from something, so many opportunities where you've not quite made where you wanted to be. But because of the insights that you've had because of that, the final success is so much better than if you had got it the very first time.
Exactly right. And it is a fear, because you watch graduates today, and the thing I think comes up as well, I think graduates are always encouraged not to take on too much. I don't know, how the graduate comes in and goes, well, start of the year when there's all the expectations and roles and responsibilities, don't put your hand up for anything and stuff. But they're going, oh, okay, no worries. And then something comes up and there's a quick pause, bang, that graduate hand is up in the air. Yeah, no, I'll look after that. And you kind of look at them going, you've got so much to learn this year already. You've got so much to do. You don't need to put your hand up to take on this role and that role and this one, because by the middle of the year, your head is going to be spinning and you're going to feel like, I'm not achieving anything, I'm not doing enough, when in actuality you are, but you felt like you had to put your hand up and go, well, I want to take these on, to be almost impressive, I guess,
well,
the word might be.
You kind of wish the graduates can not sign up to all those extracurricular things, particularly a lot, because they're process, there's admin and process in those. You'd like them to have more freedom to to say, like going back to what John said at the start, to be actually get into the concepts of education, you know, and the, what goes on in the learning, and being able to say, you know, I don't know about that, or you know, and but my students know this. How can I use that to further their knowledge and mine?
Spot on.
But when you're so busy with other things, that can be difficult because they're just too, perhaps too tired or what have you. Great answer to the question, John. You surprised me, I must admit.
It was great, yeah. But look, one of the biggest changes, and we do have to sort of cut this segment there. But if you've got anything that's any questions or any comments about gadgets and coding, even if you're an older listener, if you've been in the sense that you've been in teaching for a long time or for a few years, any memories and things that have even changed or anything like that, we'd love to hear from you because it's something that we can bring up again next year and discuss in a bit more detail. Is that right, Rick?
Sure is. Well, Adam, I'm kind of envious because at the end of 2014, you got the final anecdote in the Christmas episode, and the way that it's just fallen, you've got it again. But, however, I'm looking forward to sitting back and listening.
And before he goes, the solicitor will be in touch about last year's episode too, by the way.
Yeah. but it's funny that...
John, we all snore. For those people who are... We all snore.
It's funny Rick brings that up because obviously that's been sitting on his mind for a whole year that I got the final anecdote and he's remembered. And it's actually come in that... And that's why we missed a couple of episodes because I wanted to make sure that when it came around I was the one doing the anecdote. But no. Look, tonight's anecdote is actually... I thought it needed a Christmas theme because this is the Christmas podcast. And last year, I know we obviously spoke with this morning, but I wanted to talk about... the staff KK, and what happens with the staff KK at the end of the year when, you know, it's early December, you know, the names go in the hat and the hat goes around. Right, choose someone out and you've got to put your hand in. I guess John's already
got
the hand
John's
on
face. He's remembering all those years of KK.
Can I say, as three male teachers... Obviously, in a lot of the schools you teach in, there's more females and things. And you're more than likely to put your hand in and pull out a name that is female. And instantly your thought is, what the hell am I going to get this teacher? What am I going to get this person for Christmas? Because as males, you're thinking, oh, I'll just get, you know, it's normally a $10, $15, $20, whatever it is, the limit that you've got to get. And it's really tough.
That's how you feel. Yeah. You know, I'm going to go, I don't have a gender a problem with this. I just have, in general, just the personality and the person, like, really, and with a limit, like you said, what am I going to get? Like,
What I want to talk about the anecdote was, I'm not necessarily, I don't want to say horror stories, but something that jumps into my mind when I say to the staff KK that of a problem you had about getting a present that you saw them open and there was a look of just, I don't want this, or someone got you a present and you opened it up and you're looking, what the hell is this? But, oh fantastic. You got to kind of feign a bit of that great sort of stuff. Have you guys got any of those sort of stories?
Well, before I throw it to John, yes, I have got one. Yeah. John, I can't recall, John, if this was by the time you'd left, and I will say it's my old school, it's fine. It was the end of year Christmas event, and it was our Kris Kringle, and it was, that year it was, you got assigned a female gift, like you said, Adam, or a male gift, and when all the gifts were there by the tree and everyone was looking at them, your name came out of a hat, and you were the first person to go over and take a gift. Now, there are only five-ish males at the school at the time, so there's five gifts. I think four of them, Adam, you could tell were either six packs of beer or bottles of wine. My name was the first male name to come out of the drawer, and I thought I'd be a good Samaritan, and I thought, look, it's really obvious, boys, what's there. We all want a piece of it. But I'll close my eyes and just put in the old lucky dip. So I closed my eyes and I put my hand in and I pulled out something that wasn't heavy and felt like six bottles of beer. It was something else. And I thought, okay, I've possibly missed out on alcohol here, but we'll go with it. I opened it up, Adam. Two items. The first one was a sunglasses holder that clipped onto the dashboard of my car.
Yeah.
I don't know if I ever needed one of those. And the second one was... a clear bag, like plastic bag, not as in a plastic bag from a supermarket, but like a clear sort of thick plastic bag that apparently was perfect for putting plants in the boot, so you didn't get any soil or anything in your boot. Every other bloke opened up six bottles of beer.
Can I say, that sounds like something that was re-gifted, like, these are two things I've got in my car, that's going to be the KK present.
I can... say it now that it was whispered to me later on, it was a re-gift.
A re-gift. Ah, oh, that's terrible.
From a female staff member.
Yeah, not good.
Who will not be named.
No, of course.
Until we press stop, John. Yeah.
So, John, obviously in your time as a teacher, KK would have been somewhere. Have you got any of those sort of stories that come to mind?
Yeah, well, there was one real standout, and that was one of the staff members who was a rather older probably older than I am now, which is really old. And she got her present given to her, and at this time, and in this particular time, the presents were given person to person. So you knew who gave it to you.
Right.
You were assigned a person to give it to, and that sort of stuff. And this person opened up this thing, and it was actually, I don't know if you ever remember, the Noddy Head dolls?
Yep.
The little dolls.
Yes,
that,
yes.
And when the person who got it was very staid and opened it up, and everybody saw what it was, and you could, breath that was drawn in the room was such that it was like a vacuum. Until the person who got it either very magnanimously or actually, and I think it was actual, totally burst into laughter, tapped the head and went, "Oh, it's amazing." And the relief throughout the room was such that, you know, everyone, quick, a huge draft of whatever drink there was.
And
it was,
I love it.
And it was an absolute highlight that went on for years.
Yeah,
and
I love
the nodding-headed doll.
That is amazing.
That
Do you know that the two items that I just mentioned, I actually hid, you know, someone got a big giant beach towel at this same event, and I hid my items in the beach towel hoping they just take it home. Somehow they appeared near my person again before I left the event, Adam.
Yeah, fantastic.
Now,
we've
got our Chris Kringle on Friday, and I know that I've looked after the person. I've been assigned someone, and I know I've looked after them.
Yeah.
I know that someone filled out my Chris Kringle sheet while I was on 1 week's leave in term three, so I feel like I could have been stitched up completely.
Yeah, you could get anything. Honestly, if someone's done it for you, someone would go, right, you know, clap their hands together, rubbing, you know, that sort of stuff.
I'm very
nervous.
Could get
anything. Look, and bringing that one up, because I wanted to share that I actually really love the KK, and I do that sort of stuff. But I remember 1 year, not the presents I've got, every present I've got has been, you know, I've really enjoyed it. But 1 year, I got a female teacher, I'm not going to say what school I was at or anything, and I thought, I didn't know what to get him, so I went into town. You know, you go into town and you wander. You just do this wandering kind of, you hope that you're going to come around a corner and there's going to be a sign that says, Adam, here's your KK gift. You know, you little beauty. Couldn't find that all day. So I went into a bookshop and I actually found a book for, I think it was $12, about some really funny teacher stories and things like that. And I thought, oh, perfect gift. I thought that'd be great. There's some funny stories. When it was opened and things going on there, and that's, we didn't share who gave it, and that's what I was, thank goodness for that, because the teacher didn't look all that impressed. So I was like, that sort of stuff, and it was quickly discarded on the table while they looked around at everyone else's gifts, and someone thought, that one didn't really hit the mark. That I actually felt really, really bad, because I thought that'd be a great gift. Look, you know, it's got some funny stories, and I had a bit of a flick through, because, you know, you double check it and stuff, and it didn't seem that they enjoyed it very much, and I felt terrible for the rest of the day there at school.
I brought Terry Irwin's biography for a female gift once, and I saw the French teacher, who was quite French, open it that year, and she got it. I just remember her turning to a colleague and said, "Who's that?"
Yeah. And that's the thing, that's the worry. Oh, you got to be so careful. So thanks for sharing, boys. I know that... The KK can be a troublesome time of the year, particularly you know, when getting someone something, and obviously for us males too. The old go to present is a 6-pack of beer. So Rick and John, that brings an end to episode 49, or the Christmas episode, as we might like to call it. And it is with a heavy heart that we do bring it to a close. And John, we do want to thank you for coming on. We hope you've enjoyed your third appearance on the podcast with us.
Well, I recall just before John's, I do recall last year, Adam, when we had him on, that he was regarded as the Pope.
And, he was.
Do you feel like Santa this year, John? Or no?
Oh, well, full of blessings, I think.
Ho, ho, ho.
We won't call him a cardinal, though.
No, we won't call him a cardinal.
Please don't.
But honestly, thank you so much for joining us again this year.
It's been an absolute pleasure. And as always, the food and the beer that's been provided by Adam is fabulous. Rick has provided the room. So
yep,
that's
he has.
Probably,
so it's,
probably as much as to be expected, but that's all good.
I like the cheap shot in there, John. But
and the electricity. Thank you.
And the electricity, no worries, that's right. But we do want to just briefly, before we finish up, just reflect on the year we've had, Rick. And we've really, really, again, enjoyed the podcast. And to all our listeners, we are going to be back bigger and better than ever in 2016. But Rick, we do want to say, what's one thing that stood out for you this year with the podcast and some of the things that we have covered?
Well, the thing that always stands out is the consistency, Adam, which, and we've done our best to do that. But I must admit, and it's great having John on again, because it was the DigiCon episode that did it for me, Adam. I just felt that, you know, we have been doing this for ourselves, but it was just lovely to be recognised and to be invited, and then also just to be roving around speaking to, you know, people from our PLN. To me, that was a fantastic episode and a great thing to be involved
with. Yeah, it was a wonderful day, wasn't it? And for me, that was a highlight as well. But for me, was the follow-up, and, you know, John, you would have heard about this as well, the win for the teachers with the laptops and the payments and things for that one as well, which, you know, we had spoken about quite a while ago actually, and said we were going to follow it up, and then not a lot happened for a while, and then only just recently has it come through that the teachers have won the back pay from 2009. And gee, Merry Christmas to all teachers that have been on the laptop program, Rick.
Well, whether you like it or it doesn't, you know, you're not fussed that much. I guess we were tackling the issue from the beginning, so it's been interesting to sort of track the episodes and what happened.
And that's the beauty of the podcast, isn't it? We can bring up those things and really follow them up and in that discussion forum, and it's been really, really good. So look, we don't want to go on too much longer. Again, John, thank you for joining us. To all our listeners this year, if you've listened to every episode, to one episode, if you've flicked on for 5 seconds and said, I'm not listening to that, we appreciate every listen that we get, and we can't wait to see you guys in the new year. So from me, Adam Lavaz,
me, Rick Kayla Thompson, and for 2015, we've both been two regular teachers.